Well, torture is not my favorite subject, but it's one that a lot of us and veteran intelligence professionals for sanity have been spending a good bit of time on. It's nothing that we thought we would be dealing with, since it seemed to us that torture was pretty much taken care of by international and national law after World War II. But Mr. Former Vice President Never Tell a Lie Dick Cheney says that it works. The distinguished senator from South Carolina, I want to quote him exactly right here, Lindsey Graham, says that, I'll paraphrase what he said. He said, well, now, I want to hear the other side of the story here, because the vice president says that we got good information from that, and lo and behold, it wouldn't be around, this kind of techniques wouldn't be around for 500 years if they didn't work. Yeah. Hat tip to the Inquisition. Then there was a Army sergeant that spoke in Palo Alto a couple of months ago, and I talked to him, and he said, it works like a charm. You give me unbridled authority to treat a detainee in any way I please, and I guarantee you that I can make him confess to not one, but two solo suicide bombings. Maybe I'll just tell you in a more kind of graphic way what I think about the notion that torture is useful in gaining reliable information. And let me draw from my Irish heritage here for a story about these two nuns. They're coming back from the hospital where they worked in Northern Ireland in Belfast, and don't they run out of petrol halfway to the convent? Terrible situation. They looked under the bonnet, under the hood, and they found no gas can, but they did find a bedpan from the hospital. They said, well, that's better than nothing, so they took the bedpan down to the petrol station. Just before it closed, they get it back, and the one gun was, I don't know if you know about bedpans when they're pretty full, they're rather unwieldy. And this one nun is trying to contend with the bedpan. The other one is opening the gas cap and screeches to a halt. Is the Reverend Ian Paisley, the hard right head of the Protestants in Northern Ireland. Now, he was in a fancy limousine, you know, the kind where you can push a button and the window goes down by itself. He looks out the window and sizes up the situation with this one nun balancing the bedpan there. And he says, sisters, I don't agree with your religion, but I do admire your faith. Now, faith-based intelligence, or intelligence gained from torture, is worth exactly what Ian Paisley thought was in that bedpan. If people ask you for testimony as to whether this kind of harsh interrogation, call it enhanced interrogation procedures or what the president called an alternative set of procedures for interrogation, call it whatever you will. If you want the answer to whether it works, well, I see no better authority than the head of Army Intelligence, Lieutenant General John Kimmins. Now, this is a gutsy guy, because what he did on the same day he knew that President George W. Bush was going to advertise and extol the virtues of enhanced interrogation techniques and what he called an alternative set of procedures, on that very day, Kimmins called his own press conference right across the river, the Pentagon. What did Kimmins say? He said, no reliable intelligence has ever been gotten from harsh interrogation techniques. History shows that. And the empirical evidence of the last 5 years, hard years, also demonstrates that, period, end quote. Now, maybe it's not just because I was an Army intelligence officer way back when. I think it's more that the credibility really is due to John Kimmins and not to Dick Cheney, let's say, who had other priorities when other people were going off to war, or to George Bush, who served admirably, except when he didn't show up for the Texas National Guard. Now, I know a little bit about the Bible. I've read it. I can't say I read it through twice, as George Bush the Elder claimed his son had read. But I do familiar with it, and I've never had much truck with the demons, you know? I mean, it's a little embarrassing talking about the demons. But I'll tell you, folks, I know what the demonic is now. I've seen it up close by just reading the accounts that are available to each and every one of you if you but take the trouble to get on the web and download them. I refer to four documents. The first one is the Senate Armed Services Committee report dated December 11th. That's the executive summary. That was made available in December, and the full text was made available in May, I believe. That's chapter and verse as to how torture was implemented in the military. It's a bipartisan report issued by Carl Levin and John McCain with no dissenting voices. It's the play-by-play on what happened. Worse still is the International Committee of the Red Cross report, which Mark Danner, who was here last night, was gutsy enough to publish. Couldn't publish it here. It was published in the London Review of Books. That is a gory description of what happened to the 14 so-called high-value detainees at Guantanamo, the ones that were brought there after the fall of 2006. The next issuance was the four torture memos by the Department of Justice. These were released pursuant to an American Civil Liberties FOIA request. And they hang out there on the ACLU website. And as I go around the country and ask people if they've read any of them, usually there's a blank stare. I didn't know they were available. Well, how could you expect to be apprised of their availability by what I call the fawning corporate press? You know, caught no publicity whatsoever. Maybe a little mention here and there. And the last one is the Inspector General's report, dated May 7th, 2004, from the Inspector General of the CIA, which was issued in heavily redacted form a couple of years ago, like 95% redacted. That means black. That means, you know, I have a hunch that the cartridge makers for our printers, that they have an in with the CIA, because it took me three cartridges to print out the new version, which is only 40% redacted. But when you have a whole page in black, that uses up your cartridge, okay? That, even though there's only 60% of that document, you really need to read it. Eric Holder is reliably reported to have said that it sickened him. And it was right after, and he read the 100% of it. And it was right after that he went to the president and said, look, you know, I'm supposed to be pursuing the facts and doing justice here. You're going to have to widen the investigation that John Durham has embarked on and let me go after the folks that were guilty of these heinous crimes. What heinous crimes? 9-year-old boys. Sam Provence, who was a systems administrator in Abu Ghraib, a good friend of mine now. He wasn't an interrogator, he wasn't an MP, he was the systems administrator. He kept the computers up, but he had the night shift, and so he saw the people brought in. He worked 8 to 8, saw the people brought in and saw them dragged out, heard the screams, and was constantly asked to participate in these interrogations, and he's thankful to his dying day that he resisted that temptation. Those are just some of the examples. I could go on. Scott Horton, some of you know Scott Horton, a very prominent international civil rights lawyer and very well regarded on the Hill and elsewhere. He was asked by legislators, people in our Congress, who were preparing a bill to ban contractors from doing rape by instrumentality. Those of you who have read some of the things I just mentioned know what that's all about. They fought for this language so that the contractors in our employ would be banned from doing this. And the White House lawyers fought it tooth and nail. And Scott Horton couldn't believe it. And finally they said, well, what possible objection could you have for this? And they were silent. And then later on they said, well, there are very strict federal and state statutes against this, and we don't want any people to be vulnerable to prosecution if we change this language, if we adopt this language. I won't go into the gory details, but this Binyam Mohammed, who was released and is now in Britain, talks about what he suffered in terms of actual sexual assault with razor blades, and you can read that on Huffington Post. Naomi Wolf has an article on that just the last couple of days. And of course, this squares with what John Yoo responded when he was asked out in Notre Dame, I think, was, would there be any legal reason to prevent the President of the United States from ordering a young boy to have his testicles crushed in front of his family? And you said, no, no, there's no law against that. Okay, so you carry it right through and you see the demonic. Carol Wickersham, who's one of the board people at the National Religious Campaign Against Torture and also a Presbyterian minister, she too has imparted to people her shock and dismay and her new belief that the demonic happens to be all too real. Now, we call them enhanced interrogation techniques. We call them all manner of euphemisms. And I saw a startling use of euphemism on the front page of the Seattle Times this morning. Let me see if any of you noticed it. There was a little article about President Obama 2 weeks ago going out to Dover, Delaware to greet the incoming okay, coffins, bodies. Anybody know the exact words used? Pardon? No. No, these are not coffins. These are transfer cases. 2 weeks ago, Obama flew to Dover for a surprise, middle-of-the-night salute to the fallen as their transfer cases were transferred. Transfer cases. I mean, not only were photos banned at Dover, but now we can't even say coffin. This is Washington Post, by the way, just an article picked up by the Seattle Times. So, if people recognize that torture doesn't work, fair question, then why did we do it? Why did we do it? Why do you suppose? If it's proven, as I am morally certain, that torture can not get you reliable information, then why would you do it?
Provide propaganda?
To produce propaganda?
To produce propaganda?
Oh, there you go. If it's not reliable information you want, if it's unreliable information, man, I'll tell you, torture works like a T. Now, I'm not talking abstract here. There's a fellow named Ibn al-Sheikh Alibi, a Libyan national, who was picked up and actually had some role in running the training camps for Osama bin Laden. You know, he sort of paid the travel expenses and helped to recruit people to come to the training camps. And so he was about as close as they were going to get to Osama bin Laden. And they knew, okay, they knew that he knew about how many al-Qaeda were trained in Iraq. Except he didn't know, because there weren't any trained in Iraq. But in 2002, there was a big premium on making sure that they proved a connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. What percentage of the American people do you think believed that there was that tie as we entered the war in March 2003? Anyone? Yeah, 69% was the best figure. So it worked. I mean, this is Joseph Goebbels rejoicing in his grave. Man, these guys really know how to do the propaganda. Well, there weren't any ties. or watching Fox News. Now, what they did, of course, was they said, now, Alibi, you won't tell us. You won't tell us about the ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. And so we're going to send you to the Egyptians because they know how to get this kind of information. And so they did. He was tortured unmercifully. And guess what he admitted to? Anybody can guess? That Saddam Hussein and Iraq were training Al-Qaeda in the use of chemical and biological weapons. Now, what happened to that information? It was sent back to Washington immediately and used by Vice President Cheney in his major speech of August 26, 2002, where he really set the terms of reference for what was going to happen. Saddam Hussein is building, reconstituting his nuclear weapons. He's got all manner of chemical and biological weapons. Don't think about UN inspectors, the inspections. They just give you a false sense of security. We got to go get him, okay? And he used Al-Libi's report, knowing full well that the Defense Intelligence Agency had already blackballed him as a prevaricator, as somebody who didn't know what he's talking about. So on the 7th, on the 26th of August, Cheney used it. On the 7th of September, the president used it 3 days before the congressional vote to give him power to invade Iraq. Okay. And then our friend Colin Powell used it on the 5th of February the next year. So, you know, it's really handy stuff if you're not interested in reliable information, but rather unreliable information. As I say, it works like a charm. Now, I've learned in my old age, and maybe some of you, I see a couple of people with a touch of gray in their hair. Maybe you've had the same experience, but I learned too late to listen to my own children. But I do listen to my grandchildren. We have 8 of those. And at one point about 6 years ago, I got on Lehrer. You know, it's kind of a rare sort of thing. I guess it was a change in directors for the CIA, and they couldn't find anybody else. So I got on there, and I told Rita, my wife, and she immediately called Kathleen out in Oakland. Dad's going to be on TV. You might want to watch it. So she did with little Claire, 4 years old. They watched the Lehrer thing, and when it was over, Kathleen turned off the TV, and Claire went up to her and said, Mommy, Mommy, that was Grandpa. And Kathleen said, yeah. She said, well, Mommy, that means the other people are real, too. That's cute, isn't it? But you know what, folks? Think about it. Think about it. If you don't know someone in the picture, the other people aren't real, too. We don't even have pictures of what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq by design. Because the pictures, if you'd believe the right, made us lose the war in Vietnam. It was all that terrible publicity, you know. So what does that mean? Well, that means something pretty profound, I think. Because if you can't establish a personal connection with these folks, all the more so when they don't really look like you, they're a different color, they wear strange things on their head. We teach our soldiers to call them camel jockeys, towel heads, sand niggers. It's very easy to dehumanize people like that, and dehumanization leads very easily to torture. That's the reality, folks. You know, there have been these things happen in history before. I'm thinking of Germany in the 30s. We know that the Germans were obedient, and we know that the German churches, Catholic and Lutheran, could not find their voices. Maybe you don't know that one of the first things that Hitler did when he came into full power was to make sure that there was a pastor in every single parish in Germany. Whether it was Lutheran, whether it was Catholic, he needed a pastor in every church, and he ensured that that would happen. Why? Why do you suppose? He thought that that would be a force of stability for his regime. And unfortunately, he was right. The Germans call it the Schweigen, the silence. People look to churches for moral leadership. And if the pastor says nothing, if the pastor owes his job as much to the Nazis as he does to the church, he's not going to say anything. And people will get the idea, well, you know, it may, must be all right, otherwise he or she would say something. Now, there was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, for example, the very gutsy Lutheran pastor who tried to set up something called the Confessing Church, something true to Jesus of Nazareth's behavior and ideals. He got wrapped up and eventually hanged. But there was another fellow named, Jagger Steiner was an Austrian, and he too stood up to the Nazis. But the fellow that I'm thinking about, his name is Haushofer. Albrecht Haushofer. Anybody know about Albrecht Haushofer? Good, because I'm going to tell you. He was a geologue, okay, a geologist, sort of a geographer at the University of Berlin, and he had tenure. Now, I think some people here in this audience know what tenure means, okay? He had tenure, and he had tenure because he kept his mouth shut. And as he watched his Jewish neighbors getting wrapped up one by one, his conscience got the better of him. He started speaking out. Actually, he created quite a little following among himself there. And he represented a threat to the regime, so they wrapped him up, put him in a different Berlin prison, and sentenced him to death. Now, the SS, Gestapo, would use two means of killing you. Either they'd hang you, like Bonhoeffer was hanged, or they'd shoot you, and Haushofer was going to be shot. But before they would shoot him, the Germans are very meticulous, and of course, he would have to sign a confession. I mean, they needed the paperwork, right? So they insisted that he sign a confession, and he resisted. He wouldn't sign it. And they got so angry as the Allies became very much closer to Berlin that they shot him anyway. And as they picked him up from the floor, there was a little settle, a little piece of paper. And it was his confession. Some of you probably know German. I'll recite his confession. It's very brief. It's in the form of a sonnet. Okay? And he wrote it very carefully. And the title was Schuld. Anyone?
Guilt.
Guilt, right. And it said, Doch bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Yes, I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. I should have earlier recognized my Pflicht, my duty. Ich musste schärfer Unheil nennen. I should have schärfer, more sharply called evil. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. I put off my judgment far too long. Ich habe gewarnt, I did warn, aber nicht genug, enough. Und klar. So I did warn, but not enough, and not clearly enough. Ich habe gewarnt, aber nicht genug und klar. Und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war. And today, I know what I was guilty of. Martin Luther King, one of the most poignant things he had to say was, there is such a thing as too late. Now, can we train ourselves, or can we come back to the notion where we're supposed to care for one another? Can we live with the notion that our country has been torturing other people? I wrote an article several months ago in which I said people from the Judeo-Christian heritage had a really, really special reason to oppose torture, since Jesus of Nazareth, after all, was tortured to death. And I got an email from a friend of mine, and he said, Ray, you got to change your tune here. I'm an atheist. I know that torture is wrong. I've been doing just as much as you have to oppose it. Torture is wrong because human beings instinctively know that they're not to abuse other human beings in this way. So,
nice that you brag about your Judeo-Christian heritage, but don't think that that's necessary, because it's not. People know that instinctively. And I took a lesson from that, and that's, you know, that's something that we really need to home in on, because it is an instinctive thing. I think it's a natural thing for us to care for one another. I had an experience about 5 years ago when those very courageous women of Code Pink arranged to have Iraqi professional women come here during the spring, come to the United States and speak in various locales. And Scott Ritter, Faisa El-Jaradi, a woman engineer from Baghdad, who was responsible in part for the water purification plants in Baghdad, and I were touring around the very liberal Bay Area. Okay, so we did Palo Alto, we did the theater in Oakland there, and then we were in Santa Cruz. And I could tell that Faisa was getting more and more kind of agitated as which each night that we talked. And in Santa Cruz, we were given the kind of welcome you would expect, a very prosperous, very, very welcoming environment, very warm welcome. And then Scott and I talked, and Faisa got up and she shared what had happened in Iraq to her family. She was in exile in Jordan. To our brother, to people who were in prison, people who were being tortured. And she poured out her guts. And she got the same kind of, oh, isn't that too bad reaction. And she came back, I'll never forget it. She came back and we were sitting like the little panel here, and I was sitting here and she was here, and she came back and she wrote me a note. She grabbed my pad and she wrote this. When we come here, people very welcoming, I feel good. I felt people care. People against the policies of war and torture. But Bush and Cheney don't listen. I think of what's happening to my people as they don't listen. And I tell you all what's happening to my people. And the people, however pleasant, shake their heads and they say, oh, that's terrible, but what can we do? What can we do? Always, what can we do? I feel sick. And she put the pad in front of me. Now, I'm not the most perceptive person, but I know when peak moments arrive, usually, and I knew this was one, and I knew how to figure it out. And I knew I couldn't figure it out by myself. So I wrote an email that evening to Victoria, one of my co-teachers at the Servant Leadership School at this Church of the Savior. I said, Victoria, I know this is important. I really, really are aching to understand it. Why is it resonating so much? And she wrote right back. Next morning I had this email. I said, Ray, you remember when we were doing the racial sensitivity program? It's a Mennonite program. It's called The Road to Emmaus. It's wonderful. I recommend it highly. Remember how they divided the African Americans from the whites, and our instructor, an African American man, looked at us and he said, you know, I have to tell you, you white people, you're really something, you know. You don't like racism, and you want to act against it, but all you can think of saying is, what can we do? What can we do? Now, you have on your backs, whether you know it or not, a knapsack full of white privilege. Privileges that, for the most part, you didn't gain from your own sweat. Privileges, accidents of birth, education, the privileges, they're in your white back knapsack. And among those privileges is power. And if you dragged out that power from those privileges and put it into play, you could change things. You could change things in a way that people without power cannot even aspire to change things. Well, I wrote back and said, thanks, Victoria. I think that's what I was gravitating toward, but couldn't quite put my finger on. So what does that mean? Well, how do we change things? Well, I think after I finished here, and it won't be very long, Rob will be talking a little bit about what the Washington State Campaign Against Torture is doing, and I suggest that you listen attentively. NR, the National Religious Campaign Against Torture nationwide, is doing a lot of good things. They have a statement that's going out next week against, it's a statement urging the president to hold fast with his promise on Guantanamo. And there are all kinds of interesting things that they have done. For example, they have helped to promote and to succeed in promoting a Rush Holt. A representative from New Jersey, Princeton area. He has had legislation for 4 or 5 years saying that every interrogation needs to be videotaped. Every one. And NRCAD has succeeded with others, of course, in getting that through. And, you know, it is helpful. Some of the, well, I'm terribly grateful for my Catholic upbringing and the more recent education that I've got at Georgetown University about what Yahweh of the Hebrew Scriptures and Jesus of the New really care about. And it's really easy, folks. It's that we do justice. You know, it's like what Isaiah says in his first chapter. You know, it's not prancing around swinging thurifers and making incense. It's doing justice, okay? So I'm very grateful for all that. And every now and then there's kind of a gleaming thing comes through. And I want to share one with you. This has to do with a light colonel, Lieutenant Colonel called Vandeveldt. And he was a real gung-ho army lawyer. And he went out to Guantanamo, and he found out that the justice was being perverted right and left, that people were hiding evidence so that they could convict people, and people were just acting very irresponsibly. And he was between a rock and a hard place because he wanted to do his job. He enjoyed the army, and he said this in an article he wrote, "I wasn't able to discuss any of these cases I was working on with family or friends because it was privileged information. As I sank deeper and deeper into despair, I turned to a Jesuit priest who had written and spoken widely about justice. Some of you may know of him, Father John Deere. I could not give Father John much detail, and I sent him an email. And I told him what the situation was. And he wrote right back and he says, quit. It's simple. Don't be a part of this. Quit. and so Lieutenant Colonel Vandeveldt, 3 days later, quit. Now, I talked to John Deere about this a couple months ago. He hasn't been in touch with Vandeveldt at all, but he does know the story. And he says, yeah, I got this email out of the blue. I didn't know Vandeveldt from Adam. And so I said, well, you know, the way he describes it, I'll just write this off, quit, send it off, never expecting any reaction. So there is a place for prophetic people. There is a place for people who come out of a religious tradition or any humanistic tradition to do the right thing. And Vandeveldt, I think, is not a unique case. There are lots of other things that can be applied. But what I like to talk about a little bit is what we do as prophetic Abrahamic people. And that includes Judeo-Christian, the prophet, Islam. What does it mean to be a prophet? You know, it doesn't mean foretelling the future, of course. You know what it means. It means standing up for truth and for justice. Isaiah, for example. I don't know if any of you know this, but I learned that Isaiah was prompted to go around stark naked for 3 years. Now, biblical exegetes, without any sense of humor at all, say that, no, it's not clear that he was always naked, just during liturgical services. Now, that may be good exegesis, but it does not let the man off the hook, does it? Okay? What was he saying, folks? What was Isaiah saying to the Jews of that time? He was saying, look,
I strip myself of my clothes, and you say, oh, isn't that terrible what he's doing, stripping himself of his clothes. You are stripped of the vision with which Yahweh blessed you, a vision of justice and of shalom. Your nakedness is far more culpable than mine. Now, you got to hear the rest of the story. Tradition has it that Isaiah was sewn in half by a very dull wooden saw. And prophets very often don't come to a very happy end. But there's someone who was called upon to speak out and did so in a kind of a bizarre way. Now, some of us might say, well, you know, that's just like me. I'm a little, you know, eccentric and, you know, excentron, out of the center. But we have to check with our folks there, make sure that we have a sanity check, because we might be just kooks, you know. We have to be careful what we do. Well, what I'd like to do is just to say that Martin Luther King did point out elsewhere that sometimes you have to put your body into it. Sometimes you have to put your body into it. Chavez, Cesar Chavez, used to always say, op-eds are great, writings are great, speeches a little bit greater, but nothing's going to happen without action. Nothing's going to happen unless we take action. Dan Berrigan, who is one of my favorite prophets, I was educated by Jesuits, and Dan is the best of the breed. You know what he did about Vietnam? Let me tell you something else he did long after Vietnam. He went down to South Africa when Easter season, and South Africa was still suffering under apartheid. And knowing Dan, you won't be surprised that he spoke out at some of these white churches. And after one service, the white congregation was up in arms, and they came up and said, now, Father Berrigan, if we do what you tell us to do, we'll be put in jail. And then what will happen to our children? And Dan looked them straight in the eye, and he said, and if you are not put in jail, what then happens to your children? We're at that kind of moment now. Our civil liberties are severely endangered. It looks like we might be facing a widened war in Afghanistan. Now is the time. Just for refreshing my mind, I looked up the old Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau here. Thoreau's piece on civil disobedience, 1849. He wouldn't pay the poll tax because he didn't want to pay any taxes to a country that was going on a war of aggression. This is where we incorporated Texas, you know, the Mexican War. You know, on second thought, I think Henry David Thoreau with him had a really good idea there. But anyway. So the only tax, there was no income tax, so he refused to pay his poll tax, right? And they put him in jail. And the story goes, and I think it's true because there's lots of sources, Emerson visits Thoreau in jail. Many of you know this story. He says, Henry, what are you doing in there? And Thoreau says, that's not the question. Waldo, what are you doing out there? It was an act of conscience. Thoreau argued that we will eventually lose our capacity to make the distinction what's morally correct and what is numb. Now, Thoreau was asked at the end of his life, you know, have you made your peace with God? And he said, well, I never really quarreled with him. And I think he meant that if he, you know, quarreled with his own conscience and did what his conscience told him not to do, then maybe he'd have to make his peace with God then. Civil disobedience ends up on a happy note. After Thoreau's release
Actually, he didn't want to be released, but people paid for his release, got him out. He was actually angry at that. After his release, and a very unpleasant reception from his neighbors. I don't know if any of you have encountered unpleasant receptions from your neighbors, but I have. The children of Concord brightened his mood by urging him to join a huckleberry hunt. Now, huckleberrying was one of Thoreau's valued pastimes, and his skill at locating hidden huckleberries made him a favorite of all the children in Concord. And if a child stumbled, spilling the berries, he would kneel by the weeping child and explain that if children didn't stumble and spill huckleberries, they would never scatter and they would never grow into new seeds and new bushes. So at the end of his civil disobedience, he says this: "So I put it behind me and I joined the huckleberry party. The children were impatient to put themselves under my conduct, and in half an hour I was in the midst of a huckleberry field on one of our highest hills, 2 miles off, and then the state was nowhere to be seen, and his conscience was clear." I think that we have to remember, in all this awful stuff, I try to figure out whether there's any kind of joke that would fit in one of these presentations, because it's such dismal, dismal stuff. Just to keep my sanity, we have to remember, it seems to me, that Teilhard de Chardin was right when he said joy is the unimpeachable sign of the presence of God. We're called to be joyful people, even amidst all this terrible stuff. And so I would like to again steal from my Irish heritage to tell you about another prophet. And he's out of William Butler Yeats, and his name is the Fiddler of Dooney. I'll close with this. "When I play my fiddle in Dooney, folk dance like a wave of the sea. My brother is priest in Kilvarnet, my cousin in Bachnabowee. I passed my brother and cousin, they read from their book of prayer. I read from my book of song that I bought at the Sligo Fair. When we reached the end of time with Peter sitting in state, he'll call the three old souls, but he'll ask me first through the gate. For the good are always the merry, save by an evil chance, and the merry love the fiddle, and the merry love to dance. And when the folk there see me, they'll all run up to me, saying, 'Here's the Fiddler of Dooney,' and they'll dance like a wave of the sea. So I wish you justice in the spirit of Abraham, Isaiah, Jesus of Nazareth, the prophet, Rachel Corey, Dan Berrigan. And I wish you joy in the spirit of the Fiddler of Dooney. Thank you very much. You know, this is a really tough one. There seem to be two tracks that people pursue. One is the prosecution angle, and the other one is a kind of an educational thing. There are really good arguments for both. The crimes are clear, the documentation is copious, and so I applaud Attorney General Holder for telling the President he was going to pursue some of these other crimes that have been committed. But we also need an educative kind of body. We need some kind of commission that would have some pretense or some legitimate claim, better still, to objectivity and to honesty. I contrast that with the 9/11 Commission, which failed miserably. Actually, Governor Keene and Lee Hamilton have admitted that they were set up to fail. Their words in their book. We weren't given enough money, we weren't given enough time, we weren't given enough access to sensitive information. We were set up to fail. So it would have to be something that was set up very, very carefully and was able to be looked upon as a legitimate, unbiased, investigatory thing. And I don't know of any precedent that our country has. The precedent in South Africa, I think there are as many non-parallels with that as parallels. So to the degree we need something, we need both. I'm glad that the prosecutors are at work, but you know, a lot of that work is done in secret. What has anybody heard of from John Durham? He's the government prosecutor in Connecticut who started in January of 2007 to look into the destruction of the CIA tapes, 92 of them, of the harsh interrogations. Now, he hadn't said a peep, and that's good. Hopefully he's doing his job. But the point is that if the American people aren't educated as to what really happened, and you can't expect that from what I call the fawning corporate media, then you need some kind of body, some kind of commission to let all this stuff get out, get up in the air, so that people, you know, a commission couldn't be totally ignored, even by the fawning corporate media, I don't think.
You referred to we torture as if we are the U.S. government. Isn't that something like the Stockholm Syndrome, where we are identifying with our oppressors? Do we really run the U.S. government? Do we really have much of any democracy when 95% of the people would benefit from single payer and all the Congress says, no way, Jose, it's not on the table? When most of us oppose the wars here and there, and Congress gives it to us. And along those lines, Eisenhower warned us of the power of the military-industrial complex, who's been making trillions of dollars off of all these wars. How can we expect any kind of justice, any kind of accountability from a government that we don't effectively run?
That, my friend, is a question that really calls for some comment. I was at a meeting with Ramsey Clark about 3 years ago, and someone said all these things. You know, it happened before, and it's, you know, really bad, and, you know, how do you expect to do anything? And what he said was this: yeah, that was then. Now is now. We're alive now. It's our duty to do what we can. Now, let me just offer this suggestion. We Americans have one trait that I think is really, really a bad one, and that is that most of us are reluctant to really start anything, particularly start anything important, unless we're reasonably sure that we're going to be successful. Okay? Now, to the degree that deters us from taking action, that's a really insidious thing, in my view. We're not called to be successful, we're called to be faithful. The good is worth doing because it's good, okay? And the sooner we get it through our cross, that we may not be doing this for ourselves, but rather for our children or for our grandchildren, that we will stand up like the good Germans did not stand up, and make sure we can do everything we can to stop this torture. Until we do that, until we're willing to risk arrest, until we're willing to be arrested, as I have for four times now, it's a cop-out to say, well, we don't have any control. Government's really out of our hands. We are supposed to be a democracy. These things are done in our name, you know? And so it seems to me that it's up to us to divest ourselves from the certitude of success and just do what we can. And that's what I would appeal for each and every one of you to do, to end not only needless wars, but the horrid practice of torture. I'll say just one more thing. I'm a glass half full person, okay? I also have a big jet lag here, so. Okay? Now, what does that mean? That means that I see more hope than most of my colleagues. And the reason is this: against incredible opposition from everybody and his brother, from all the national security folks, the generals, and the intelligence people, Obama faced up to them and said, I'm going to release those four Department of Justice torture memos, and I'm not going to let them be redacted. How many of you have read any of those torture memos? Ah, this is an unusual group. Usually nobody has. Download them from the ACLU website, and you'll see why Obama, I think, released them. That, and now, of course, we have the CIA Inspector General report that was kept ever since May 2004 secret until August when it was released. Now, why did he do that in the face of that kind of opposition? Why did he broaden the terms of reference of John Durham, the prosecutor's portfolio in pursuing not only the destruction of the CIA interrogation tapes, but going after people who, you know, put loaded or put guns to the temple of masked detainees and that kind of thing. Why? Well, I think as I said before, Holder read those memoranda, read the full Inspector General report from the CIA, and decided, this is sickening. I have to do something about it. He went to Obama and he said, I'm going to have to do something about it. I'm the Attorney General. I'm supposed to pursue the facts and do justice. And Obama, I'm guessing, said, damn, I want to look forward. But okay, go ahead. All right? Now, those are big. Those are really big. I mean, what happened? What happened when he authorized that? Do you remember what the past CIA directors did? Who remembers? What did they do? They wrote a letter to whom? To the president. And they said, please, please, be reasonable. Don't go after these people. And then there's one royal line in it. It says, there's no guarantee. We're very concerned. There's no guarantee that the limited terms of reference laid out for the government prosecutor won't be bridged and it will become a wider investigation. And maybe, you know, three of those seven were in power when all this stuff happened. George Tenet, Porter Goss, and Michael Hayden. So, you know, you have the most transparent and most irregular, not even discussing whether it's legal to ask for an investigation that has been authorized by the Attorney General to stop. I mean, there are some that argue that's accessory after the fact, you know? So there they go, and they argue this thing, and, you know, Panetta was right in there with them. And so I'm calling them Panetta and the Seven Dwarfs. And they are dwarfs. They're moral dwarfs. And the situation that the CIA has come to at this point is due to those celebrated directors who say, please don't investigate us for approving torture because it might expand the investigation to involve others like other directors. It's just, you know, really, really bizarre that they thought they could do that. How do they think they could get away with that? Well, because the Washington Post and New York Times are rooting for them. Washington Post and New York Times are talking to retired and ex-CIA officials who are saying how terrible this would be. And, you know, the crowning thing is they were only following orders. What does that sound like? Now, that was dismissed at Nuremberg as, you know, completely inadequate defense. Now, I'm not saying that it's best to go after the Lindy, the in England equivalents to the CIA people that were torturing people. But I think that it's a hopeful start. You know why? And again, this is just me. My colleagues are much more pessimistic. I'm thinking that, okay, they go after the fellow who held the revolver to the hooded detainee. They know who he is, and they say, that violated even the very permissive regulations of our very permissive Department of Justice. And so we're going to hang you out to dry. What's he going to do? Is he going to be like Lindy England from Abu Ghraib and say, oh gosh, okay. Or is he going to hire a military lawyer? No. What he's going to do is get himself a good lawyer. Okay? And what's that lawyer going to do? He's going to say, well, my client was instructed to do this by A, B, C, and D. And here's one of the orders. And A, B, C, and D's lawyers are going to say, oh, our client was instructed to do this by E, F, G, and H. And by the time they get up to L, M, N, and O, and P, it's going to be George Tenet Dick Cheney, the president, and Don Rumsfeld. And that'll be a good thing. Now, that may be too optimistic, but that's the way the judicial system works. And there are probably a few people here who remember Watergate, but that's how they did Watergate, folks. They got the little guys and they gave them really stiff sentences and they sang like canaries. They found the tapes and it was, you know, justice was pursued. I think Obama's got an awful lot on his plate. I tend to be a little bit more patient with him in thinking that he's got, you know, the economy, he's got the global warming, he's got all kinds of stuff to deal with. Health care is a big one. And so he's trying to keep a lot of balls in the air and can be forgiven for not taking on this thing right away. But I think what he also needs is lots of pressure from us. And, you know, he's pretty much said that. You know, he's quoted FDR by saying, make me do it, you know. And the final thing I'll say on this is that I was reading just the other day with Martin Luther King Jr., a one-on-one with Lyndon Baines Johnson. And as he leaves, LBJ puts his arm around Martin Luther King and says, now, you go out there and fight just as hard as you are and make it possible for me to do the right thing. Now, that's what we got to do, folks. That's what we got to do. And let me read from the prophet Daniel Durrigan here, because I think it points up the situation we're in. He wrote this during the Vietnam War. He says, we have assumed the name of peacemakers, or anti-torture people, one might say, but we have been, by and large, unwilling to pay any significant price. And because we want peace with half a heart, half a life, half a will, the war, of course, continues. Because the waging of war, by its very nature, is total. But the waging of peace, by our own cowardice, is partial. So a whole will and a whole heart and a whole national life bent toward war prevail over the vanities of peace. Of course, let us have peace, we cry. But at the same time, let us have normalcy. Let us lose nothing. Let our lives stand intact. Let us know neither prison, nor ill repute, nor disruption of ties. There is no peace because there are no peacemakers. There are no makers of peace because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war, at least as exigent, at least as disruptive, at least as liable to bring disgrace and prison and even death in its wake. I think we're at that point, folks. We have to summon the courage to do the right thing, whether it's to stop a war or to stop torture. And I would appeal for you to get together with a small group of trusted friends. This is what we suggest. This is the ethos of the Church of the Savior. 5, 6, no more than 6. Make sure that there's at least one woman in this circle. It's the women that have the guts, it seems to me, and the insight to be prophets in this kind of milieu. Okay? You meet with them regularly every week, and you will be surprised what wisdom comes out of that sharing. You will be enlightened, inspired, to do things that none of you would have thought of individually. Not only that, but when you decide what you're going to do, then there's a community to hold you accountable and to make sure that you do something sensible. That's where it starts, folks. Margaret Mead was right. Margaret Mead was right. A small group has always been how it starts. And so I'd recommend that to you. It's worked for us at the Church of the Savior. I think it could work for any little group that wants to pursue justice and has wants to pray for the courage to do so.
I think that we should end there and have a little mercy on Ray McGovern's jet lag.